Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the other face of Facebook and look into how the co-founder of the social network is avoiding $600 million in taxes. Elise Hoag, former senior advisor to Media Matters and director of political advocacy and communication at MoveOn.org, joins us to discuss this and how the 99% can level the electoral playing field as the 1% pour in millions to buy the 2012 elections. Then we'll look into increasing political tensions in Spain, where youth unemployment is over 50% and mass demonstrations are expected to culminate tomorrow on the one-year anniversary of the founding of the Indignants movement. Anthony Geist, a professor at the University of Washington who specializes in contemporary literature and culture of Spain, joins us to discuss the political mood in a country that might soon join Greece as the next insolvent country in the Eurozone. Then finally, we'll discuss the economic and political tensions in Spain further with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, a professor of Spanish studies at the University of Illinois Urbana. We will look into the Spanish national identity that has not been reconciled following the murderous reign of the Franco dictatorship and the role of the disgraced king and the current conservative government who are imposing austerity while denying historical memory. And joining us now is Elise Hoag, who is a social change practitioner, media consumer and analyst, and online engagement expert. Previously, she served as senior advisor to Media Matters for America, director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, and program director at the Rainforest Action Network. She was the recipient of the Business Ethics Network Award in 2005 for her work in the financial sector and has been a frequent speaker and writer about corporate power, corporate accountability, and multinational institutions that govern and financial and corporate behavior. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Hoag.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And you have an article at Agence Global that caught my attention, Lessons in Disloyalty, Eduardo Saverin and the Facebook IPO. Eduardo Saverin, of course, is the co-founder of Facebook. He was featured in the movie The Social Network as something of a victim that his friend, his Harvard roommate, Zuckerberg, had sort of aced him out of Facebook, but he nevertheless ended up with 4% of the shares. And to save $600 million in taxes, he's giving up his U.S. citizenship after having been essentially welcomed to the United States as a political refugee from Brazil. Not exactly gratitude.
Well, right, especially as you mentioned, since his family moved here when he was 13 from Brazil because he was under the threat of being kidnapped since his father was a wealthy businessman. So the U.S. took him in and provided him a home. He became a citizen in 1998. He attended schools, even including Harvard, that get a generous amount of taxpayer dollars to make them that the excellent institutions that they are. And then, as you said, you know, it's a little cut and run for Mr. Saverin ahead of the IPO that stands to make him billions of dollars.
So he'd already set up shop in Singapore, right? That's where he's moving to.
Yes, he's in Singapore. He apparently has been back and forth. And, you know, we don't know the details because they're private. We do know that his lawyers claim he actually renounced his citizenship some months ago, but the IRS reported it last week. And, you know, as you say, the timing is a bit suspicious. The interesting way that our tax laws work is he will actually have to pay, quote, an exit tax in order to renounce his citizenship, but the exit tax is valued by his own team of accountants and lawyers, what they think he's worth at the time he renounced his citizenship. And so the timing is a bit suspect, since regardless of when he announces it, as long as it's before the IPO, he will be worth much less than he will be when the price is publicly fixed in the billions and billions of dollars.
So in the movie The Social Network, as I mentioned, he was portrayed as something of a victim of Zuckerberg, having been his roommate. He put up the seed money for Facebook and then got aced out of the investment. What's your understanding of their relationship today, if any?
Yeah, I don't have any personal insight into that. I mean, I think it's, you know, one of the things that we need to watch is how Mark Zuckerberg has said himself he will be paying the $1 billion. He's asked the board to slash his salary next year to a single dollar. And so there's a really different personification of the wealthy one percenters, this new generation that risks feeling as though they are not bound to any country like sovereign versus Zuckerberg, who's been an epitome of giving back. But the one thing I do want to make sure your listeners get is, you know, and this was one of the reasons that I was moved to write the article, is that there are so many millions of people who really aspire to be part of the United States with all of the giving back that that requires. They only want to pay their taxes. Even undocumented workers in this country pay their taxes. So when someone of the wealth and privilege of sovereign comes along and actually uses the resources of our country and then skates off and doesn't give back, it could really do a disservice to help people understand the spirit of giving and entrepreneurship that really is embodied by most immigrants who aspire to be American.
And in your article, Elise Hoag, Lessons in Disloyalty, Eduardo Saverin and the Facebook IPO, you point out that according to the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, undocumented immigrants in the United States paid over $11.2 billion in taxes in 2010.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, I think people don't realize that anytime there's a paycheck, they get taxes out, but more and more, there's sales tax, right? And there's not a single person in the United States that does not pay a sales tax. So often you get the middle class and working class immigrants who are actually doing what they are expected to do to become American citizens. And then you've got the one percenters who seem to be the same all over the world, really.
So, Elise Hoag, the 4% share that Saverin has in Facebook, in terms of the IPO, the upcoming IPO, that he skipped town in order not to pay $600 million in taxes, he must be getting one hell of a payday.
Well, the $600 million figure is projected actually by another writer in Pando Daily, but it seems to match up with a lot of the estimates on what he would be giving back to the Treasury on future capital gains income from the sales of those Facebook shares later on. So that's over the course of his lifetime. But yeah, his 4% share, which as I mentioned in the article, was awarded to him by a judge because certainly we saw in the movie Zuckerberg and Sean Parker wanted to edge him out of the deal. His 4% share is projected to be worth somewhere between $3 and $4 billion after Thursday when the IPO goes public.
So you're saying that Zuckerberg, by comparison, is virtuous. That's certainly not what the film shows.
I'm not positive I would go that far, mostly because I just don't know the guy. But what we have seen is that he's not in any way protesting, that he will probably have the largest tax bill that anyone has ever experienced in this country in one fell swoop. He's obviously was made famous a couple years ago for writing a $100 million check to the city of Newark for their school system. There are obviously critiques to be made of Facebook generally, and lots of people are making them. They have no women on their board. They still take advantage of corporate tax loopholes that are costing the Treasury billions. But in contrast to his co-founder, I think we're seeing someone who's not protesting that he actually owes his country something for the start it gave him.
Again, I'm speaking with Elise Hoag, who was a senior advisor to Media Matters for America, director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, and program director at the Rainforest Action Network, and the recipient of the Business Ethics Award of 2005. And, of course, this is really, I mean, I imagine people have said this to you before, that business ethics nowadays looks like an oxymoron.
It can sometimes, although, you know, I have to say that we are seeing a much more robust debate than we were 10 years ago about what it means to be ethical in the context of the encroaching corporate power. And, you know, I intentionally use the word one percenter rather than 1% because we do see, you know, there was a wonderful subset of the Occupy movement that was a 1% for the 99%. So values are values. Wealth in and of itself is not a bad thing. The question is how you use that wealth to make sure that the entire society benefits, because, of course, you know, a healthy society benefits everyone.
Well, we've had the J.P. Morgan Chase chairman, Jamie Dimon, whose company just lost $2 to $3 billion. He had been a very aggressive critic of regulation and had been quite dismissive of Paul Volcker and the so-called Volcker rule. Dismissive is putting it politely.
Mildly.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think anyone is actually going to hold up too many of the banks as the paragon of virtue when it comes to new evolving models of corporate behavior. And in fact, I'm not sure that what we're going to see is any one corporation emerging as the sort of leader on social responsibility. We are seeing corporations start to play a little bit with what it means to, A, face backlash if they get out of line with their customers' values, right? We saw that with Apple and the iPhone when all the stories emerged about their business practices overseas and the conditions under which their workers operate. And then we saw Google experimenting with what it means to actually fight for open internet with the SOPA PIPA fight. So I think that we're just starting to see the potential power of the pocketbook and how we govern the corporations and what we expect of them. Now more than ever, people understand that their consumer choices are a reflection of their own values. And so we're going to, see corporations having to sort of evolve to respond to that or be the dinosaurs that we're seeing in the oil industry and the banking industry. And I don't think they have a long-term future unless they get their act together.
Well, two of the most egregious dinosaurs in the oil sector are the Koch brothers, who have aggressively invested in politics and in right-wing politics and in the Tea Party, and they're playing a very active role in this election. And I don't understand why there hasn't been a consumer boycott against Dixie cups and brawny paper towels and the many consumer products that they produce.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and it's one that, the groups that are engaged in trying to affect change at the level of the Koch brothers really need to explore. What we have seen, though, that does get at the Koch brothers' influence is an enormous amount of consumer pressure for companies to leave the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is heavily Koch brothers-backed, and as your listeners may or may not know, has been really the sort of feeding ground for right-wing legislation, including the, quote, stand your ground, what we like to call kill at will bill, that ended up, getting George Zimmerman potentially off the hook for shooting Trayvon Martin. So Coke, Pepsi, I think we're up to a dozen corporations that have left the ALEC structure, which is heavily Koch brothers backed, and one of the ways that they have tried to move legislation through the state level.
Well, it's interesting, the idea that these bilious billionaires, if you will, are so enabled by the Citizens United decision. I mean, the very nature of the 1% versus the 99% has had to be revised. And one of the latest numbers I heard was, in fact, the people who are buying this 2012 election, who basically are dominating the money race, are these super PACs. And in effect, our political future in this key election year is being decided by the 0.00063%.
Yeah, I'm not ready to actually cede this election year. I really do think that one of the benefits of Citizens United is that it's been a tipping point for many Americans to wake up to the corporate control of our democracy. And we're seeing an awareness and a pushback that is largely unprecedented about the money and politics issue. So I'm hopeful. In fact, I wrote a piece for The Nation a few months ago called Will Citizens United Actually Unite the Citizens? Because we know that the only thing that can really combat money and politics is citizens organizing together. And I think that the wake-up call of all of these anonymous third-party ads and its impact on our communities has really mobilized people in a way that we haven't really seen. So it may take a couple of cycles to really see the impact of that organizing, but at the end of the day, we do know that people power can actually combat money.
Well, I had a couple of campaign strategists, who, one of whom had run John McCain's presidential campaign and another run a number of Democratic presidential campaigns at a forum out here at UCLA that I host. And they basically said that what happens in our election years is that billions of dollars are raised from the special interests by candidates who effectively sell their soul. And then this money is turned over to the networks, or the main network monopolies, for ad buys. And that all of these buys basically go to the swing states in an election, which is only about a quarter of the electorate. And then later in the year, as we get towards October, all this money is funneled in to about between 3-6% of people are being targeted. And these are the people in October who still haven't made up their minds. And then by October, if you haven't made up your mind, you tend to be in a demographic that suggests that you're a mindless couch potato who never reads newspapers and what follows what's happening in the news. And the idea that our electoral fate is in the hands of morons is really quite disturbing. But they provided the statistical information.
You know, I will take issue with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle who put forward that. Not the basics. The basics is absolutely correct, that the money gets funneled to the networks and the network buys are disproportionately in the swing states. That's all absolutely true. I think that one of the things that political consultants don't give people credit for is the fact that they actually tune into issues that matter to them in their daily lives. And so there's a couple of different things at play when you're trying to speak to people through whatever mechanism. And one is actually persuasion, and there's this sort of holy grail of the swing voter that happens every single cycle and who can win them. And, you know, I think that sometimes they're more informed than others, but often they're really just paying attention to who they think is going to help them more, especially in the times of the slipping economy, which we're seeing now. There's also getting your own people out to vote and communicating in such a way that makes people feel as though their participation in democracy matters. And that's the part that concerns me the most about Citizens United, is that if we actually convince people that if they don't have $1 million to spend, that their participation in our democracy doesn't matter, there's a lot more at stake than who wins the next election. But on the point of the television, one of the things that's going to be really interesting as we head towards 2016, 2018, 2020, is that it's really an age demographic that is dependent on broadcast television for how they get their information. And that's disproportionately where all of these ad dollars go. And so what we're going to see is that it's going to be much more important to get very sophisticated on social media, very sophisticated in terms of micro-targeted ad buys on cable or on the web, in order to reach the sort of growing up class of voters who really don't watch television straight through with the ads and everything that our parents and grandparents did. So we're going to see the entire landscape of how we communicate to voters change in the next 4 to 8 years.
Well, Elise Hogue, we're having a somewhat different conversation from the Facebook IPO, but I'm fascinated by what you're telling us. But that's not to say that negative advertising doesn't work. I mean, it's been proven, I think, time and time again, that it, despite the despicable nature of it and how much it's dominating the airwaves, negative advertising tends to work. It certainly worked for Romney in bringing down Newt Gingrich. And my understanding is that in spite of the $1 billion that President Obama is supposed to be having to raise, he's going to be outspent in this election, probably by a substantial amount of money. So with a failing economy or a limping economy and the possibility of a euro crash that could impact it negatively, this could be a very good year for Mitt Romney. Do you think he can buy the election?
I think it remains to be seen. I think one of the things that you said I totally agree with, which is that the forces on the other side, because they know that they can get the Republican candidates to do their bidding, they have infinite pockets and they're willing to spend what it takes. The question, and I should say, I'm not in the business of predicting elections this far out. I've seen too many things change in the course of the last 6 months. I think it's very hard to predict. But I think the challenge for the Democrats and progressives who care about reelecting President Obama or just trying to get their local representative elected to the state senate, because a lot of legislation is moving at the state that actually is impacting our lives even greater than the gridlock we're experiencing federally, right, is that we've got to challenge ourselves, be innovative, and think about one of the things that we know that is more effective than negative advertising is peer-to-peer communication. Is that I go out and talk to as many people I know who trust my impression, and then they go out and talk to as many people as they know. It's basic old organizing, but we've got new tools to do it. And I think it's going to be a challenge to see if we can utilize those tools in a way that combats the big money, because I think there's no doubt, you're correct, that you know the deep pockets will definitely be able to outspend Obama and all of the other candidates on the Democratic side.
Well, just in closing, Elise Hogue, you certainly hit the nail on the head there in terms of what's gone on at the state level. And the Koch brothers, of course, and Alec have been very much involved in the blizzard of legislation that's changed the nature of a lot of the state governments. It's almost as if we've gone back to the period before, was it the 13th Amendment that led to the direct elections of senators, because previously to that they were appointed by state legislatures, which were in turn controlled by the big railroad barons and other corporations. And it sounds as if we're sort of going back to that era where the state legislatures are controlled by big money, and they've proven that. And I don't see any countervailing equivalent on the political left to how well organized the right has been and how much they've got the jump on everybody.
Well, I mean, it's going to be an interesting thing, and that's why it's so important for everybody to watch what happens in Wisconsin. The conventional wisdom was that Governor Walker was absolutely untouchable because he was backed by so many big donors, and yet you've got over a million people that in the course of several months signed a recall petition, and now the guy's political future is actually in question. There's still a lot of work to do, and there's 3 weeks before the election. But one of the things that we've learned, not only with the ALEC measures, but with all of the state measures that are really oppressing immigrants right now and actually rolling back decades of women's rights and reproductive choice, is that this is a national playing field, and some of it happens at the state level. So state fights are fights for everyone because they move the goalposts and they change the national debate about issues that impact all of us. The good news about the state fights is that it goes back to the peer-to-peer organizing, and when you're on a smaller playing field, you can actually touch more people. So, you know, I hope your listeners will not only pay attention to what's going on in Wisconsin, but everywhere around the country, because it's what could happen in your state if you don't think about organizing in terms of your own political priorities and your own values.
Well, I thank you, Elise Hogue. I must just say in closing that piece of video that came out of Wisconsin showing a woman who's a local billionaire, basically telling Scott Walker what she wants him to do, which is to turn Wisconsin into a right-to-work state. And he's quite supine and quite obedient. If ever there was the face of the 1%, I know that's not what the focus in the media was, but to my mind, that woman really was the face of the 1% in terms of buying our politics.
I absolutely agree, and that is the face of one potential future, but I have seen too many fights being won with just good old-fashioned organizing to be too pessimistic. So I would like to leave your listeners with the idea that if we actually all get engaged and all actually passionately pursue the kind of democracy we want to see, we really can make a difference.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Elise Hogue, who's a social change practitioner, media consumer and analyst, and online engagement expert. Previously, she served as senior advisor to Media Matters for America, director of political advocacy and communications for MoveOn.org, and program director at the Rainforest Action Network. She was the recipient of the Business Ethics Network Award in 2005 for her work in the financial sector and has been a frequent speaker and writer about corporate power, corporate accountability, and multinational institutions that govern financial and corporate behavior. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the anniversary of the indignants, those that feel indignation against what's happening in Spain.
Can't buy me love.
that makes you feel all right. I'll get you anything, my friend, if it makes you feel all right. 'Cause I don't care too much for money, but money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anthony Geist, who's a professor of Spanish and comparative literature at the University of Washington, where he specializes on contemporary literature and culture of Spain. He's just returning from Spain. He's also the author of a book on the Spanish Civil War, and particularly the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, which he co-authored with the Spanish photojournalist Jose Moreno, Passing the Torch, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and Its Legacy of Hope. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthony Geist.
Thank you, Ian.
Now, you're just back from Spain, and of course, Spain is beset with over 50% youth unemployment, and the banking sector was reorganized, or an attempt was made last Friday to reorganize the banking sector that's still reeling from the 2008 housing bubble crash. Is there a sense in Spain that they're following along the path of Greece?
I've been to Spain several times in the last about month and a half or 2 months, and I noticed this last week when I was there that there is greater pessimism than I've ever noticed before. Greece, I think, is a very is very present in everybody's minds. There's been talk of perhaps leaving the euro system. It's the only way they can devalue their currency and be able to deal with the recession, or as many people feel that's the case.
So what is their understanding, though, of how they got into this mess? First of all, my understanding about the housing bubble was that it was inflated largely by Germans buying second homes in Spain, and obviously a lot of overbuilding took place, as was the case in Ireland. Germany, of course, has been the beneficiary of the euro, and they're proving to be kind of fair-weather friends. They're kind of rejecting the Greeks and the Spaniards and others on cultural basis, that they don't pay their taxes and they're irresponsible and they're not frugal like the Germans are. Is there any kind of cultural backlash in Spain?
Well, there is resentment against Merkel and the Germans, although it's, you know, I think it's inaccurate to attribute the burst of the housing bubble to Germans buying second homes. That certainly was part of what fueled the housing boom, but it was in large part it was speculation by Spanish construction companies. There are currently over 1 million unoccupied and unsold new apartments in Spain. 1 million. And that was not all for Germans looking for second homes. It was, it was fueled by this speculative fury. And money was available. It was cheap credit, cheap mortgages. And this fueled this, this building and construction fury. And of course, that sector is entirely dead now in Spain.
So this obviously contributes to unemployment, but what is the main, it surely is not sufficient to explain over 50% unemployment amongst the young.
Yeah, well, there's just, Spanish economy is, it's not a largely manufacturing or productive economy. It's in very large part a service economy. Part of the bottom has fallen out of that. There are very few jobs. Actually, Spanish youth are exceptionally well educated. Because they stayed in school, they stayed in college, gotten their degrees, because there's no work when they get out. And so that's, I think that's the real crisis. I'm not an economist. This is what I see, as a frequent visitor and someone who knows the culture well.
Again, I'm speaking with Anthony Geist, who is a professor of Spanish and contemporary literature at the University of Washington, where he specializes in contemporary literature and culture of Spain. He's also a scholar of the Spanish Civil War, in particular the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. He co-authored a book on that, Passing the Torch, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and its Legacy of Hope. How much, though, just to touch on the, not so much on the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, but on the Spanish Civil War, is there the legacy of the Spanish Civil War, the fact that there was no kind of truth and reconciliation, there's been attempts at it, but it's not really happened. How much is that still festering between the left and the right in Spain, and has that led to any kind of political impasse?
Well, it has indeed led to serious political problems between the left and the right in Spain. The Spanish Civil War is still very much present in the Spanish psyche. It's the wound that has never healed in Spain. Particularly in the last 6 or 8 years, there's been a movement which is called for the recovery of historical memory in Spain. And it began as a citizen movement, people wanting to locate the mass graves where their parents and grandparents and great-grandparents who were victims of the Franco repression were buried in unmarked graves. It began, as I say, as a citizens' movement. It was picked up by certain people in the judiciary and in the government and in politics. This is ultimately what's led to the dismissal of Judge Baltasar Garzón last month, or in February, from his position on the Spanish judiciary. He was accused of exceeding his authority by authorizing the opening of these mass graves and the exhumations. So it's a very, very hot-button issue still in Spain. There's, you know, no family in the country does not have relatives who were affected, you know, on one side or the other of the conflict. And although it was 70 years ago, it's still very much present.
So I followed the Judge Garzón trial, and it did feel that it was a sort of political payback for him pushing too far. So there's obviously enormous resistance in the conservative Spanish establishment. What's the role of the king? Because he recently disgraced himself. He's the head of the World Wildlife Foundation, and he's off there shooting elephants in Africa, which was just beyond belief in terms of, it's polite to say it was a public relations gaffe. I mean, I believe one of his sons is actually quite urbane and quite liberal in his outlook. Tell me about the Spanish conservative establishment.
Well, the Spanish royal family and the king particularly has actually been very well loved by the Spanish people for the king's role in the transition to and the consolidation of a democratic regime after the death of Franco. There was an attempted coup in 1981. Franco died in very late November 1976. In 1981, there was an attempted coup, and the king did not back the military officers who were leading the coup. And the restoration of democracy was very largely attributed to him. The latest debacle has done great damage to the royal family, to their prestige. In addition to hunting elephants while being the head of the World Wildlife Federation, it also took place. The incident took place on the 14th. Of April, which is the celebration of the founding of the Spanish Republic in 1931, which was overthrown by Franco. So it was a very, very unfortunate constellation of events.
So again, Anthony Geist, professor of Spanish and contemporary literature at the University of Washington, specialist on the contemporary literature and culture of Spain, and just back from Spain. One of the reasons why I've been following the European crisis for so long, and it's pretty hard to understand how Merkel and company have allowed it to continue on. They've never built a sufficient firewall to stop the bleeding, and now shoes are dropping like Greece and possibly Spain. And clearly it's going to have ramifications for the American election if there's a crash of the Eurozone. And that will, of course, cascade back here. And we may end up with a Mitt Romney as a result. Is there a sense in Spain that they're a part of a larger drama?
Well, yes, there is, in fact. I think that's clear. The world is interconnected, particularly with communications technologies and so forth, which have changed the way we understand the world and our place in it. Still, my sense is, just having been there on the streets, is that people are experiencing this as very, very personal and a very Spanish tragedy, misfortune. There's a very bleak outlook. They don't really seem to see any way out of it, to understand any way out. I know there's, they follow American politics. The people I spoke with speak with scorn of Mitt Romney and still with considerable admiration of Obama. How that will change if the euro goes belly up in Spain, that may be a different matter, and how it affects U.S. economy and politics.
Well, you were there on Saturday for the first anniversary of the Indignant Ones.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So tell us about that and that movement.
Well, it's the Occupy movement, sort of avant la lettre. It was they camped out in the Puerto del Sol, which is both the real and the symbolic center of the country in Madrid, for many months. And there were demonstrations called on Saturday for all over the country. Every major city in the country had demonstrations in commemoration of the first anniversary of 15M, the 15th of May movement, the Indignados, the Indignant Ones. And I actually left in the morning, on Saturday morning, so I saw it through on Facebook and YouTube, instant links, direct links. Puerto del Sol at 4 o'clock in the morning was packed with people, despite the mayor of Madrid forbidding camping there, staying beyond a certain time of night. I don't know if it was 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So there is I think there's a great sense of indignation with the government's response to the economic crisis in Spain. And this is both the recently elected conservative government. The Indignados movement began under Zapatero, under the Socialist Party. And there's the feeling I have is that there's a kind of a pox on both your houses. The new Popular Party government has not been able to respond in any effective way to the crisis either.
So that's very much like the Occupy movement here in the United States. They are zealously unaligned certainly they don't support the Republicans, and they're leery of the Democrats. So that seems to be fairly universal in terms of the Occupy movement. But clearly, they got more skin in the game, if you will, if half of the young are unemployed. Just in closing, what's going to end this indignation, this sense that half of the population are unemployed? I imagine the entire generation under 25 in many ways feel like a lot of the kids that brought about the Arab Spring, that the older generation have screwed things up for them and stolen their future.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the most chilling statistic that I've heard is that the population between the age of 18 and 35, 45% of that age group have never held a job. They've never had their first job. So one of the responses, of course, is a brain drain. The Spaniards are looking for work throughout Europe, young Spaniards, and in Latin America. And also the other response is this indignation on the streets.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Anthony Geist.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Ian. Very, very happy to do so and to actually have been there and been able to see it.
Again, I've been speaking with Anthony Geist, a professor of Spanish and contemporary literature at the University of Washington, where he specializes in contemporary literature and culture of Spain. He also is a specialist on the Spanish Civil War and on the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, the American Volunteers, the so-called premature anti-fascists. He's the author of, the co-author of the book, Passing the Torch, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and its Legacy of Hope. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking further about this crisis in Spain.
Spanish eyes, teardrops are falling from your Spanish eyes. Please, please don't cry. This is just adios and not
goodbye. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, who's a professor of Spanish Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana. She was raised in Spain and specializes in contemporary Spanish studies, culture, ideology, and Spanish national identity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Delgado.
Thank you so much.
So, the main square in Madrid, the Puerta del Sol, has been emptied by the police of the indignados, the indignant ones, and they've been protesting over the weekend, culminating with the one-year anniversary protests, which are supposed to take place tomorrow, but the police seem to be proactively trying to get rid of them. What's your understanding of what's going on in Spain?
Well, the new government, which is a conservative government, I think has a very peculiar understanding of democracy, unfortunately, and they have for some time now, they have been proactively trying to enact measures to in a way kind of privatize public spaces, because they don't want people to congregate. They don't want people, especially young people, to be in the streets because they are indignant. They are mad, and they are usually not pro-government. And now, by law, you can in fact detain somebody and take them to prison for a few hours if you are in the streets after a certain hour protesting with a crowd. And that is, of course, utterly undemocratic. That is not what you have in a democracy, especially when it's a peaceful demonstration. But what other means do people have of protesting? They don't feel that they're represented by the political institutions, and they don't think politicians are in fact doing anything to improve the situation of Spanish people, and in particular its youth. So they're usually very peaceful, and it's very unsettling to read these what is happening in Spain.
So, Dr. Delgado, tell me what you're learning from your relatives in Spain.
Well, it's interesting, but it's sad because I think everybody knows somebody or has somebody in their family who is unemployed. And many people who are unemployed, and that is the same in my case, in my family. So I have a 30-year-old sister who has a partial disability and was receiving a very small amount of money from the government, to help her because she's trying to finish a degree, and that small amount of money is going to be ending pretty soon, and of course that's a problem. But I mean, she's studying, but even she's trying to get a part-time job, and of course she's unable to, even though she's bilingual, she studied in an English school, she is finishing a degree, she's an educator, but there are no jobs available. She lives in Zaragoza, which is a smaller town, you know, and that Madrid or Barcelona, I mean, and there's simply no jobs. Her husband was in sales, and now there's no sales to be made. So he is also unemployed, and I have a brother-in-law who is 50-something who is working computer in the computer science industry, and he also lost his job last year. And, of course, at 50, it's hard to find another job. People are depressed, and people are angry, very angry.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, professor of Spanish studies at the University of Illinois Urbana. She was raised in Spain and specializes in contemporary Spanish studies, culture, ideology, and Spanish national identity. Now, I understand this, there is a brain drain going on in Spain, and the young Spaniards, 50% of whom are out of work, are looking to emigrate, and a lot of them are looking to Central and South America and Mexico.
Yes. And it's, of course, ironic because until a few years ago, Spain has been traditionally a country of immigrants. You know, Spaniards had to leave Spain towards the end of the 19th century, the 20th century, for different reasons, for economic reasons and also for political reasons. And I myself, I'm the daughter of political emigres, you know, who went to Venezuela. And
you're talking about your father was a Republican?
My grandparents were Republican, yes, and they left Spain right after the Civil War because obviously the situation in Spain was not very good for them.
Well, they may not be alive today had they stayed.
Exactly. So, you know, they went to Venezuela and you know, obviously it was like many, many other people, and they created a new life for themselves. But my father left Spain for economic reasons, like many people did. He's from the Canary Islands, and you know, there was no future for him. He also went to Venezuela, and that's where my parents met. So we are a country of immigrants. And then Spain had this economic miracle, you know, so-called miracle. And then we became the receiving end of immigrants from other countries, especially from Latin America and from, Latin America and Africa. So we, from other areas of the world, I should say. So, and then people got used to, in a way, being what they perceived to be a richer European country. And now, of course, we're going back to the beginning with Spaniards leaving the country. And yes, it is really sad because who's going to be left after all these young people leave? The people who are well prepared, who can work, who have studied, and who might have solutions for the country are, in fact, leaving. And not just for Latin America, they're also going to Germany, they're going to Northern Europe. It's very interesting. This didn't happen since after the Civil War. Spaniards going to Germany, that's what they did, you know, in the 1940s. So that it's happening again. It's a different type of immigrant, you know, of course, it's a different type of worker. Now they're highly skilled workers, some engineers or computer scientists or professors in many areas. And so it is a highly skilled workforce that Spain is losing, yes. So I don't know. And they're cutting funds for education are being cut in a drastic way. So I really don't know how politicians expect the country to recover. Who's going to be there to work on behalf of Spain and the Spanish people? I do not know.
So do you think, Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, that Spain will follow the path of Greece and default because the banks are insolvent with 50% unemployment? And the government is doing what all of these governments have done in Greece and the rest of Europe, and the Republicans are trying to do over here, bring about austerity, which
exactly.
Of course makes no sense when
makes
you
no
have
sense. Mm-hmm. It just, doesn't work. I mean, a lot of economists. I do not. You know, I am not an economist. I do not claim expertise in that field, but very good economists say this is not the way out. It really isn't. And, I think today the Minister of Economy in Spain said, we've done all we can, we cannot do anymore, we need the cooperation of the European Union. That was in today's newspapers. So that means that, yes, that they don't know what to do. They simply do not know what to do. Which is, of course, what many of us suspected when people voted, really gave a big electoral win to the conservatives, I mean, many of us thought, where is this going to take us? Because they didn't have an economic program either. I mean, they simply didn't. But I think people just wanted to punish the socialist government for its failures, and it certainly had its failures. And it was more a punishment, as it has happened in other European nations. So it really doesn't matter what the government is; people vote against the government at that particular moment. And yeah, so it seems that they're saying without the European Union, Spain cannot make it. So I don't know what the solution will be, but they insist on these austerity measures that are. It is creating a disaster, a disaster in the country. And, I mean, I laugh, but it really is very sad, of course, very sad.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, professor of Spanish studies at the University of Illinois Urbana. She was raised in Spain, specializing in contemporary Spanish studies, culture, ideology, and Spanish national identity. And there, of course, has never been truth and reconciliation in Spain following Franco and the murder of so many Republicans and these mass graves. And we know that the judge Garzón tried to look into it, and the conservative establishment came after him. And, you get the feeling that even though the conservatives are in charge now, they're making things worse. They never really went away. Do you think that that's in the sort of political DNA? The fact that there's never been the truth about what really happened in the Civil War and the brutality of Franco has never really been fully told?
Well, that is certainly the case. Part of the political agenda of the current government is really to erase historical memory. I mean, it is not convenient. Many of them are the sons and daughters or grandchildren of people who were in Franco's government or who participated in the war, and I mean they don't even disagree with many of Franco's principles, and some of them say so not so rather openly. You know, it's not even a huge secret, and certain things are said publicly in Spain that would not be tolerable in Germany, for instance. I mean, they simply would not be tolerated.
I think they're against the law, aren't they, in Germany?
Exactly. Yeah.
To talk about fascism and support Hitler.
Yes. The new Minister of Justice is changing laws to kind of trying to change laws to what they were almost at the beginning of the democratic period. So we do see that ideologically things are going backwards instead of going forward.
That
will create a big problem, of course.
Sure. Because,
it will create a problem certainly with Catalonia that they already exist. It is a big problem within the Basque Country, where the conservatives didn't win, and that's the only one of the few areas in Spain where they didn't win. So the central government is pushing this idea of national unity and national cohesion, but of course. They're doing so in a way that it will have the opposite results.
Well, just in closing, what do you make, though, of the king's recent ridiculous behavior? Here he is, the head of the World Wildlife Federation, and he's found he's off shooting elephants. And, of course, it happened on the day of the birth of the Republic. So is this a reflection of the fact that the Francoist never really went away, even though he himself, the king, of course, stopped a right-wing coup that would have perpetuated the Francoists?
Well, I mean, it is debatable whether he did, in fact, stop the coup, and that's a very, of course, it's a matter for a different debate. But there have always been some sources that said that he was part of the idea for the coup, and then when he saw how things were developing and how far they were going, he kind of backpedaled and said, "Oh wait, that's not what I meant." So that is one issue. Many people do not believe that he was not part of that attempted coup, and in fact, as you probably know, one of the main the people who were involved in the coup had been his teacher. It was a general who had been his teacher and was very, very close friends with the king. So how the king could not have known what this person was preparing is difficult to understand because they were very close. But yes, so what happened with the elephants? To me, this as any crisis, it gives you the opportunity to see kind of in a way what's wrong at the very bottom of the issue. So of course there's the economic crisis, but I think there are other issues, and Spain does need to understand that democracy requires transparency. And I don't think that Spaniards are really educated in that. I mean, we went from a dictatorship, which was, of course, completely opaque, where nobody knew what nobody was doing, and the people who had power could do whatever they wanted. And we transitioned to a democracy in a way that was bloodless, and in some ways it was very interesting. But I don't think we really, as a country, I mean, we have no tradition of democracy, I mean, except for this long period, of course, that we've had since Franco. But what truly are democratic principles, which again involve transparency in the way decisions are made, decisions that affect citizens, and also a sense of responsibility for those decisions, those are not really deeply ingrained principles in Spanish society. I mean, I always say, I joke to my family that in Spain nobody, when they do something wrong, nobody says, yes, I take responsibility and I quit. I just quit my job. I will quit. Or they don't. They simply don't. They stay, and it seems that nothing happens. So to me, the issue with the king, and I'm not really, I think it's very difficult to explain a monarchy in this day and age, but really is the question of transparency. The king is, in fact, above the law. The king does not have to give explanations as to where he goes, why, what is at what expense. Only after the scandal it was said that he would inform the government of his whereabouts. That's insanity. We have a head of state who has no political responsibility.
Well,
and that is the problem. Aside from the fact that it's horrendous that he is taking part in these hunting, expeditions, hunting animals who which are on the verge of extinction. It's horrendous. But really, why did Spaniards not know about it? We have no idea. You cannot, in fact, insult the king, mm-hmm. because you can be taken to court and taken to prison.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here today, Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, but I thank you very much for joining us. It's been a very interesting conversation.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Luisa Elena Delgado, professor of Spanish studies at the University of Illinois, Urbana. She was raised in Spain, and she specializes in contemporary Spanish studies, culture, ideology, and Spanish national identity. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Christian Vasquez. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.